being able to turn results with increasing our NOI is that we're able to help all of our investors to realize their futures, their retirement, whatever they want to do with their contribution. And their contribution is contributing to the community.
If you have over $200,000 sitting stagnant in your bank, retirement account, or home equity, then you're literally losing money. On this show, you learn how to get that money working for you consistently and conservatively. Learn to grow your nest egg with your host, Sean Winslow. Let's dive in.
Hey, Rebecca, welcome to the show.
Hi, Sean. Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Hey, no, thank you. I know you're busy, so it means a lot for you to take time out of your day to jump on and share some knowledge with the listeners and myself. That's the cool thing about these podcasts is it's one great way to network. And you as the guest obviously share stuff with our listeners, but I always learn stuff. So I love it for that aspect too. So let's get into it. If you don't mind just sharing your story, who you are and what you do today and how you got there.
Okay. Well, that's kind of a long story, so I'll try and keep it short.
Yeah.
Okay. So I grew up in California and eventually went down to San Diego to get my PhD. And there I met my sailor, my husband, who was a captain in the Navy. And as we were trying to figure out what to do with some houses that he had bought in Virginia and Corpus Christi, Texas, we actually had two in Virginia. As he was coming up on his retirement, we were saying to ourselves, what do we do with these houses? Should we keep them? Should we not keep them? And so we went to a real estate expo where we heard about people learning to do syndications of apartments. And we had never heard of such a thing. And a lot of people didn't, because actually the whole syndication thing didn't really even begin in the early 2012 or so. That's another long story. So we found a mentor that was really great and thought, okay, he is selling his education. And this was Brad Summerock, and he lived in Dallas. So we said, okay, we're going to sign up for this education and learn about it. So I would then fly to Dallas from San Diego almost every other month.
Oh, wow.
So that was a lot of determination. Now, my husband, he was in charge of a squadron of ships. And you don't go out anywhere when you're the head of this squadron of ships. So, you know, he's like, Rebecca, you go do it. At the time, I was a psychologist at the Naval Hospital and loved serving all the people there. But again, it began as a side hustle. So I learned the Texas market and made great friends, because again, we were meeting each other almost every other month there in Dallas. And that's where I met my partner, my first partner, Dustin Miles. And he was an engineer. I being a psychologist, it was kind of a good mix, because he was so meticulous and so great about teaching me how to underwrite and knowing how numbers work, where that wasn't necessarily my strength. So really, people, if you don't think you can do it, that's okay, because you're going to find a partner who knows what you don't know.
That's right. Yeah, my partner's actually an engineer too. So
yeah,
I'm with you on that. You know, details, I can do it, but they're just not my forte.
Yeah, so you find the yin to your yang, per se.
Right.
And so that was a really great thing that happened for me. So then learning about the syndications, we would go on the properties, learn about the apartments themselves. And I, of course, was surrounded by a lot of really great motivated people who were syndicating much before me. So I'm learning from their experience. And my first thing that I did was, of course, become a limited partner, a passive investor in some of these folks' syndications, so I could really learn how it works, because I had no experience at all.
Early on in Brad's groups, were people primarily investing just in DFW? Is that why you picked that? Or is that people still investing all over the country at that point as well?
No, it was primarily in DFW for all the right reasons, meaning that it's landlord friendly, business friendly, that the prices, especially because this is 10 years ago, were very good. And of course, most of us over in California know that it's not as easy to buy apartments and have to be at all landlord friendly. So it made sense to us to be buying in Texas, even at that time.
That's wonderful. What a great time to start buying in DFW. All right. So you joined the group, you met your partner, and then you did some LP. And for those that aren't familiar with the vernacular, limited partner. So on the passive side of the deal, she invested in it and then the general partners managed it. So Rebecca, why did you choose to, like, you went to the seminar, you already had some smaller real estate deals going on. Why didn't you just go right to the GP side? And why did you choose to go the limited partner route first?
Very good question. And this is great for everybody to think about. I mean, the reality was I had no idea how to run an apartment building, how to take other people's money and have the confidence in me when I didn't know what I was doing.
Right, right.
So it was really great for me to start out as a passive or limited partner, because when we become a passive investor in the deal, what happens is, first of all, we learn about the apartment that the GP is purchasing. And we want to learn, of course, what are the good and the bad. So, for example, a good one might be one that has 1, 2, and 3 bedrooms. That's next to a school. That's in, of course, a great neighborhood that maybe doesn't have too much value add, that this person's going to be overwhelmed depending on their level. So next, when your limited partner, is that you're going to receive all of the financials and the monthly update, if it's a good sponsor, that they should be communicating completely. So when I got what's called the T12 or the profit and loss, I would read through it to see what's happening on this property. And of course, at the beginning, I had no idea what that was, but just in trying to underwrite my own deals later on, but learning the facts sort of in the beginning, that was useful to say, okay, what is delinquency? What is economic vacancy? And so through those newsletters that I would get, I began to understand, as well as continuing our education, you know, in the group. So it all culminated together so that when it was my turn, or after I really dug deep and got my own syndication, I really kind of knew what was happening. So that was very important. So I feel that it was really great to be an LP before jumping in to something that you have no idea of what you're doing.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I feel benefit a lot more people than probably do that, especially we've seen it over the past couple of years, the amount of people that have gotten into the business. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's a wonderful business, but they see how great this business is because it is. There's no question about that. So you can see why they just want to jump in immediately. But I think to your point, unless you've managed some type of business, because that's what this is, each property is a business. Unless you've managed people, processes, systems, you could be in for a rude awakening. So I think to your point of being a limited partner at first, seeing, especially you're going to either learn that you're with a good sponsor and you want to emulate them, or you're not with a good sponsor and you don't want to do those things. So you're going to learn either way. Hopefully it's the former, not the latter. But yeah, I agree with you. And so at what point did you feel kind of confident then to go on and be like, I got this. It's time to step into the general partner arena?
Yes, probably about a year after learning, having this education that was ongoing year after year. I started in about 2014. And once Dustin and I started to underwrite together, that's another sort of teaching moment right there, is that being with somebody who's much more experienced than you are, that's really helpful to become a GP. So underwriting. Again, it took me about a year to find a good deal. And some people might think, oh my gosh, that's forever. Well, I really wanted to have a home run of a deal. I didn't want to jump into anything that was risky, because this is your reputation. So yes, a lot of people are really good at the finances or already had a business or had more real estate experience. But I, luckily too, Dustin was like, no, you need to have the best deal, because if you're going to stay in this business, you can't have a dud, especially in the beginning, to be able to keep your investors and your investors know that they're safe. So my first deal did end up to be in a place called Hearst, Texas, which is right between Dallas and Fort Worth. So really great school system. Again, the 1, 2, and 3 bedrooms, lots of families stayed there for a long time. And it was a great deal, but I had that confidence because I partnered with somebody who already had experience.
All of that is very smart. And I think because to your point of reputation, if your first deal doesn't go well, I don't want to say impossible, but it could be to do the next one, right? It makes it that much harder. So I think that was smart. Even though it took you a year to find that home run deal, it just sets you up for the future so much, a lot stronger position, let's say. So what did you learn from that first deal? Because I remember my first deal, it was at times it was like drinking from a fire hose. You do all you can to prepare, but when you're actually in the trenches running, operating a deal, it's different.
It is a lot different. So many things come up. You have no idea. Yeah. So I learned everything. But I think one of the fun things was asset managing. That's something that has become a strength of mine that I enjoy, but it's very taxing. It's very lots and lots and lots of things to learn. But learning what the KPIs are for your property management, keeping ahead renewals. So what that means is that as each month comes in and people's leases are up, being able to possibly retain those folks and keep them in your community if they're a good tenant is really useful, obviously, for your occupancy and your NOI. Learning things to keep that retention was great, but also learning about having to fix the building and having reliable people. Now, I did have, again, a property management company, but they didn't always get the best people. So
that's the story. Yep.
You've had some experience with that then.
Yeah, we could have a whole episode on property management companies, what to look out for, the do's and don'ts. At the end of the day, like, they're a fee business, right? So they're going to do what maximizes their revenue. And that's, they're not all like this, but to an extent they are, you know, they're going to do what's best for their top line, not necessarily yours. So I think to your point of asset management is one of the most crucial things, because in layman's terms, the staff is managing the property management company is managing the staff, and then you as the asset manager are managing the property management. And there are times you try not to do it because you don't want to break the chain of command, but there are times when you need to actually get on site and handle things. At least we've had to. And I think sometimes leading by example is really powerful when you can get out there with a drill or whatever it happens to be, a paintbrush, and show them this is the way things need to be done. One of the things that are important to us is the appeal, the look of the property, right? The curb appeal. Some people, that's not as big to them because they don't see a direct ROI versus renovating a unit. But to me, like looking as a lens of a consumer, that's the first thing. You feel that in real estate when you drive into a property, walk into a property. Perception is everything. What do you feel in those first few seconds, those first few moments? So that's huge to us. Landscaping, trash. When we go to our properties, like, we'll go and announce sometimes, but we'll also go unannounced because you're not going to get that white glove treatment when you come unannounced. And if there's trash, we're taking pictures, sending it. Like, this is not to our standard. And I think that's important. And at the end of the day, I think you've hit on this already, but it comes to personnel. To me, that's what can make or break your operations. And that's from all the way from on-site all the way up to asset management. But no, I digress. I didn't mean to take over. I want to love to hear more on that from you, though. Any war stories you may have or any insight you may have from an operations standpoint and personnel standpoint.
Okay. You brought up so many things. It's rather exciting, actually, to talk about it. But yes, training your PM, your property management company, to have the same heart that you do in even picking up trash. That was something that I did plenty of on some of our properties. When it comes to curb appeal, though, I want to talk about one property that we bought down in Houston in the Galleria area. And we were really attracted to this apartment building because it was so ugly. All right. We called it Castle Grayskull to begin. And really, they must have gotten a sale on paint that was just, everything was gray. I mean, it looked like a dungeon, a jail. It was horrible, just horrible. And yet this building was full of so many beautiful architectural shapes and designs that it was just really tragedy what the prior owner did to this building. So in the first year, our job was to paint this. And so we hired a designer to help us to get really beautiful paint that accentuated all the architectural pieces of this building. And if anybody wants to look it up, it's at 3001 Hillcroft in Houston. And again, just look at the before and after pictures that you can see on the timeline in Google. It's gorgeous now. And so what we did is we brightened it up with light almost white colors. But then we also had a geometric mural put on the front. And then all the architecture, again, everything that we could do to accentuate that. And it came out beautiful. And that building went from the low 90s to consistent 100%.
That's amazing.
Occupancy.
I'm looking at it right now. It's beautiful.
Are you looking at it?
Yeah.
Can you see?
Yeah. That's beautiful.
Oh my gosh. It's amazing. So at the very beginning, to be able to paint the building is often a great way to begin that curb appeal, of course, to make also contribution to that community. Because again, this thing looked like Castle Grayskull, absolutely ugly eyesore to something beautiful that tenants want to live in.
That's the biggest thing. I love what we do from providing investors with great returns. We spoke about this earlier. That's part of the reason I left my previous career. I just felt, you know, it wasn't aligned with what they were saying they were doing, obviously, right? Make a long story short, they just weren't providing the return they should have been. So I love that. But the best feeling to me is to that point you just said, and I've had it happen multiple times, when you're on property and a resident comes up and thanks you for the work you're doing. To me, there's no better feeling than that. It just makes it all worth it. And a recent acquisition we just had, we just put in new lighting on the outside, new security cameras. And that's just the start, because we just took the property over, freshen up with paint, better landscaping. But already the tenants that we want to stay there are already thanking us profusely for that. So I think that's true. And we always start with the exterior too, because one, for the residents that are there, because you're not going to flip their unit if they're staying, obviously, right? So they're actually getting a benefit. And then two, the neighborhood, you're creating a buzz. If you're just turning units, no one on the outside is going to know you're doing anything. It's just going to look like the same old building. So I think that's important. So I'm glad you brought that up. But yeah, I love those stories. But yeah, sorry, I didn't mean to jump in. Continue if you have anything more to add.
Oh, no, that's exactly what I'm getting at too, is that not only are we doing great things for communities, but for people's lives where they live. When we put in a new playground, it's great for the children. And then also being able to turn results with increasing our NOI is that we're able to help all of our investors to realize their futures, their retirement, whatever they want to do with their contribution. And their contribution is contributing to the community. And that ranks really high with me. I love all my investors, so grateful for them. And when I do my monthly updates, which again, for everybody that's an LP, you should get a monthly update or at least a quarterly update from your sponsor. So what I like to do is I like to put in a lot of extra pictures. So I charge my managers with, sorry, peeps, you got to take pictures. I want to know what's going on, because I want to bring that investment to life for my investors so that they can see the kids back to school event that happens just in our office. It might not be great, but they can get folders and crayons and pens and all sorts of stuff that we can get from even the dollar store. A lot of times we have our vendors, such as like the tow truck company or the landscaper, they'll bring in these products for us to have an event for the people. So whether it's Father's Day, Mother's Day, holidays, et cetera. That keeps, again, the retention, but giving to the people to want to stay there and have a good life. It's really neat to contribute.
That's amazing. Yeah. And obviously, one, you want to provide a great place for them to call home. But from a business standpoint, too, it just makes sense. Turnover is one of the most costly things for any property. So if you can keep them there, it's phenomenal. And keep them there because they want to be there, right? Because it's a wonderful place to live. I want to highlight, you also brought up too, though, is communication, investor communication. I think this is something that's often overlooked. And I think some people just think of it as, it's a formality, just got to do it. But no, I agree with you. We do it monthly. Pictures worth 1,000 words. We have pictures, the good, the bad, the ugly. If it's there, we share it all. You know, we give them updates. If it's probably on the front end, if you're doing heavy CapEx value add deal, it's probably going to be a bigger update because a lot's going on. But we also share financials every month. We have a variance report that shows us where we are on our actual versus budgeted expense lines, right? And then we also share, you know, the bank statements of every bank account that's linked to the property so they can see all money coming in and out. And I think I just learned it from my previous career. I think it's just important to be as transparent as possible, because after all, you're the steward of their hard-earned money. So to me, it's a no-brainer, but I think it's often overlooked. And so I'm glad you brought that up.
Yeah, that is something to absolutely be asking your potential deal sponsor when you're an LP to see how do you communicate. And if it's not up to par for what you believe is right. And so just as you and I have said, we believe that monthly updates, all the financials should be given to the passives. That's something important to look out for. But yeah, it just makes sense. And it helps with trust. And as far as communicating with my investors, I think my investors know that I'm so proud to have them with me, that these folks have been with me for 7 years. When I think about, again, first starting, I have repeat investors that trust me and trust what I'm doing because I'm letting them know everything I'm doing. Luckily, again, starting back in, let's say, the good old days, you know, when cap rates were compressing and prices were cheaper, we were able to do some really great turns on these investments. But what is more important is that they know that they can call me. They know that I will answer them, that any questions that they have, again, I'm going to get back to them as soon as I can, because it means everything to let them know that they're cared for and that I'm working for them.
That's a sign of a good sponsor too, right there. You said the same people, meaning return investors, right? So that's a wonderful sign. And I guess that's a great conversation to have is you've been an LP. What are things that potential LPs should be asking or looking out for? I think to that point, one thing is what is their retention of investors? Like what's the rate at which people reinvest? That's a high number. That says a lot about the sponsor. So is there anything that you would have people look out for or ask maybe some questions that should be asked?
As far as being an LP, to find yourself a good sponsor, yes. So what I mean by that more specifically is an assembly line per se, that you're going with the most successful operation over and over and over again, that it's not just kind of winging it each time. LPs can ask if they are, let's say, a full-time sponsor or a part-time sponsor. Asking, sometimes people can't do it all with a W-2. Some people can when you have a lot of good partners too. So what is the structure, the GP structure? Who is the asset manager? I think that is huge. For my first two, me and Warren, my husband, were the sole asset managers. And since then, we have partnered with others where we are co-asset managing. And that means that Warren and I have a finger on the pulse. We know we're attending all those meetings. We are on the property in many cases. I think that's important for an LP to know if their sponsor is at all involved with the asset management.
Yeah. And to your point of having finger on the pulse, it's really important because in this business, you can get that finger off that pulse really fast. And to like mentors too, I think that's important. If anyone's seeking a mentor, to make sure they're still in the business, because maybe they were a rock star 3 years ago. Well, we know a lot has changed in 3 years. But yeah, so the future, Rebecca, what, obviously neither of us have a crystal ball here. What do you see going forward, or how are you positioning your business to weather whatever storm might be coming when it comes to multifamily?
I have pivoted somewhat where my friend Dustin and I are, Dustin and Hayden, we are together buying newer properties. And they have operations in place. We have tenants that have the ability to keep up on their rents. So not as much, let's say, on the C-class side, where there's lots of value add. But with these changing times, definitely wanting to have a tenant base that is able to make their rents and us keep good operations. Now we have great equity to go with it. So being able to finance these in a better way, have a better exit strategy than those before, is where we want to continue going in the future, mm-hmm. is to have a nice building, great tenants, and be able to get these products at a discount when we can.
That's amazing. Yeah. So it sounds like more of like a momentum play, right? Not heavy value add, but, you know, ride the current tailwinds that are in your market, most likely improve collections, limited delinquency. I love that strategy, and a newer asset. So a repair and maintenance should be lower. I think that's a great strategy, because at the end of the day, like I said, we don't have a crystal ball, so we can't predict when rates are going to come down, when capital is from a debt side of the table, when capital is going to flood back in at reasonable, not only rates, but terms. So I think you just have to play the hand that's in front of you. Obviously, you want to position yourself that if things do change, you can take advantage. But I don't think you can just solely make decision on that, because there's so many factors and variables that can change. So I think that's very smart. And we've continued to do the same thing. We are looking for that higher quality of resident, right? We know will pay. And there still could be value add play to that, but probably not $20,000 a door, right? It's tougher, right? Because if you want non-recourse debt, it's tougher to get that now, especially if they're going to finance part of that CapEx budget. So with lower LTVs, not financing your CapEx, it's really hard to get the numbers to work. And you don't want to really over-leverage yourself in this market. Yeah. I don't want to take too much more of your time, but this has been a wonderful conversation. Before I ask you the last couple of questions here, where can listeners find you?
Yes, well, at starboardequity.com is our website. And starboard, like the starboard side of a ship, the right side, the privileged vessel. So we have that. And I'm also on LinkedIn.
Awesome. All right, Rebecca. Well, I have a couple quick questions for you. And we've kind of touched on this because we've talked about being an LP and how that's a great way to start. But what are some pitfalls that you think a lot of newer operators fall into, and how can they avoid those?
Okay. Well, rushing into things. I also have the privilege of coaching some folks. And so people get so excited that they'll jump into something without having much knowledge, or partner up with people that they don't really know. Remember, people, this is a 5 to 7 year marriage. And when you get in with somebody that you think is really great, but it ends up they don't have the same values, that they're not as nice as they first seem to be, it's a long time. And you're giving your friends and family's money, your investors' money, in with this person. Please do not jump in too quickly. So I think that's huge.
That's so true. I think that's a point of, if you are going to get in partnership, view it as a partnership. Don't, I think a lot of people make the mistake of, they think they found the perfect partner right out of the gate. And they're like, oh, let's create a business together, instead of maybe let's do a deal together and see how it goes. And then they create a business. And then that's harder to separate. Because like you said, you can get out of the deal. You still want to do your due diligence, because 5 years is still a long time. But after 5 years, you can get out of that quote unquote relationship versus building a business and then investing in several deals. No, I think that's a great answer. One that's not brought up enough. I think we've seen that a lot in the last few years, the fear of the FOMO, the fear of missing out.
Right.
And that creates people to make rash decisions.
Right. And that's where the patience needs to come in. Where, example, I had some friends that had met, was like, no, hold on. You don't know these people. You don't know the product. Don't get over your skis, because they were just so passionate about wanting to get in. But that is not the way to go in this syndication, especially because of your investors, your reputation. You need to be patient. So be patient and have an abundance attitude. There are plenty of deals out there for you, but be sure it's good.
Agreed. All right. Next question. Usually I talk about resources that people can utilize to further gain knowledge about multifamily investing, operating, but we've talked about mentorship and coaching. What would you say is a good way for people to sniff out who they should learn from and who they shouldn't? Because there's a lot of options out there, and not all are the ones you should take.
Yes, understood. So many of the companies out there have big events, and you need to go to plenty of them. And they are going to be all around the country. You've got, again, Brad Sumrock, you got Rod Khalif, you got Jake and Gino, you've got VSV, Vertical Street Ventures in Phoenix. They all have academies and such, and they will all teach you how to underwrite. I would suggest that a person go to at least one of their events to see what the culture looks like for each of those people. I didn't name Joe Fairless, Michael Blanc. They all have great programs. And so go see that program. Go get the vibe from the people in that program. And they're all going to be very different costs. Now, what the reason why you might want to go with one of these, let's say, schools is because they are going to teach you how to underwrite. And that is so essential. And they are going to have people who have more experience than you do that you can potentially partner up with and or learn from. Many of them also have their own coaching programs as well. So this is something that you can take step by step to learn how to do this business, because it can be very cutthroat and you can lose a lot of money if you don't know what you're doing. So that's what I would suggest first, is to go to as many as you can virtually or get in the same room and see which one seems to speak to you.
Great advice. All right. Last question we got here. It's a good old time machine question. And I do it a little different, Rebecca, because I come from a personal finance background. So it's not what you make, but what you keep, right? Every Monday, I talk all things multifamily. Every Friday, personal finance. So if you could go back in time and give your younger self one piece of personal finance advice, what would that be?
Personal finance advice. I'm going to frame it in a psychological way, not necessarily giving you a full answer, but I grew up in humble beginnings and I have had a scarcity mentality most of my life. And so if I could go back to tell my younger self about there is abundance you can have beyond your wildest dreams, that don't be afraid to spend the money on your education to grow yourself. So what I mean by that is, when we started this journey into multifamily, it was my husband who said, buy the plane ticket, get the hotel room. It doesn't matter what it costs because it's going to pay off in the long run. And he was right. I was worried about, oh my gosh, we're going to pay this much money to a mentor. Are you kidding? Well, it wasn't any more than a college class. So who was I kidding? But I had that scarcity mentality because we didn't have much money growing up. Don't sell yourself short is sort of the advice I would give my younger self. And I would say, if you feel it in your heart and it's a good journey for you to learn, spend the money on it.
I love that answer. Might be one of my favorite ones. It's so true. I think in anything in life, it comes down to mindset, right? And personal finance definitely does. You need to be willing to do what it takes and get your mental frame in the right place to be able to get to where you want to go. Almost there. I got your entire answer though.
Okay, good. Okay.
And I was just going to say that was a phenomenal answer. I love that answer. I think it might be one of my favorites because I think anything in life is about, a lot of it has to do with mindset and getting your mental frame in the right place to be able to accomplish what you need to accomplish. So Rebecca, I just want to thank you for taking time today. This has been a wonderful episode. I've really enjoyed this conversation. So thank you.
Good. Me too, Sean. It's such a pleasure to meet you. And I just wishing you abundance.
Thank you.
You have a successful career ahead of you. And you mentioned that you're getting married. I hope it's a wonderful journey there too.
Thank you so much. And right back at you, I hope you just continue to flourish in your business and whatever you want to do in life. To your point earlier, there's an abundance mindset, right? There's tons out there for all of us. And yeah, so thank you. That means a lot. And for listeners, we've been battling through some technical difficulties. You probably won't hear it. And in your mind, you should thank Rebecca for fighting through it because she's provided us a lot of great value. So thank you, Rebecca.
Thank you, Sean.
And listeners, as always, easy doesn't pay well and instant gratification is self-destructive. So not only get out there and work hard for your money, but have it work hard for you so we can all create the lives of our dreams. Because I think at the end of the day, personal excellence is what makes this world a better place. All right, everybody, catch you on the next one.
Hey, this is Sean Winslow. After being in the financial service industry for years and having candid conversations with good people just like you, I realized that so many of us are wanting an investment strategy that provides solid returns and consistent income without the bumps in the road. There's little known secret that your financial advisor doesn't want you to know. There is an investment out there that is less volatile and the returns are stronger. Get more details by going to greenbriercg.com and clicking on the free e-report. And by the way, if this show has provided you any value, then feel free to leave an honest written review and of course, share it with a friend who needs it. See you next week for another great show.